past week I've been wandering all over, hiding at night, not eating more than a few scraps of food, sick with fear, unable to sleep more than a couple of hours at a time. Then I hear someone shout at me, you chase me over a field, hit me, drag me to your house. Then when I get sick because you shove a plate of reeking garlic in my face, you tell me I'm infected. Her hands twitched in her lap. What did you expect to happen? She said angrily. She slumped back against the couch back and closed her eyes. Her hands picked nervously at her skirt. For a moment, she tried to tuck in the torn piece, but it fell down again, and she sobbed angrily. He leaned forward in the chair. He was beginning to feel guilty now, in spite of suspicions and doubts. He couldn't help it. He had forgotten about sobbing women. He raised a hand slowly to his beard and plucked confusedly as he watched her. He started. He swallowed. Would you let me take a sample of your blood? He asked. I could. She stood up suddenly and stumbled toward the door. He got up quickly. What are you doing? He asked. She didn't answer. Her hands fumbled awkwardly with the lock. You can't go out there, he said, surprised. The street will be full of them in a little while. I'm not staying here, she sobbed. What's the difference if they kill me? His hands closed over her arm. She tried to pull away. Leave me alone, she cried. I didn't ask to come here. You dragged me here. Why don't you leave me alone? He stood by her awkwardly, not knowing what to say. You can't go out, he said again. He led her back to the couch. Then he went and got her a small tumbler of whiskey at the bar. Never mind whether she's infected or not, he thought. Never mind. He handed her the tumbler. She shook her head. Drink it, he said. It'll calm you down. She looked up angrily. So you can shove more garlic in my face? He shook his head. Drink it now, he said. After a few moments, she took the glass and took a sip of the whiskey. It made her cough. She put the tumbler on the arm of the couch, and a deep breath shook her body.
Why do you want me to stay?
She asked unhappily. He looked at her without a definite answer in his mind. Then he said, Even if you are infected, I can't let you go out there. You don't know what they'd do to you. Her eyes closed.
I don't care,
she said. Chapter 17 I don't understand it, he told her over supper. Almost 3 years now, and still there are some of them alive. Food supplies are being used up. As far as I know, they still lie in a coma during the day. He shook his head. But they're not dead. 3 years, and they're not dead. What keeps them going? She was wearing his bathrobe. About 5, she had relented, taken a bath, and changed. Her slender body was shapeless in the voluminous terry cloth folds. She'd borrowed his comb and drawn her hair back into a ponytail fastened with a piece of twine. Ruth fingered her coffee cup.
We used to see them sometimes, she said. We were afraid to go near them, though. We didn't think we should touch them.
Didn't you know they'd come back after they died? She shook her head.
No.
Didn't you wonder about the people who attacked your house at night?
It never entered our minds that they were.
She shook her head slowly.
It's hard to believe something like that.
I suppose, he said. He glanced at her as they sat silently eating. It was hard, too, to believe that here was a normal woman. Hard to believe that, after all these years, a companion had come. It was more than just doubting her. It was doubting that anything so remarkable could happen in such a lost world.
Tell me more about them,
Ruth said. He got up and took the coffee pot off the stove. He poured more into her cup, into his, then replaced the pot and sat down. How do you feel now? He asked her.
I feel better, thank you.
He nodded and spooned sugar into his coffee. He felt her eyes on him as he stirred. What's she thinking? He wondered. He took a deep breath, wondering why the tightness in him didn't break. For a while, he'd thought that he trusted her. Now he wasn't sure.
You still don't trust me,
she said, seeming to read his mind. He looked up quickly, then shrugged. It's not that, he said.
Of course it is, she said quietly.
She sighed.
Oh, very well. If you have to check my blood, check it.
He looked at her suspiciously, his mind questioning, is it a trick? He hid the movement in his throat in swallowing coffee. It was stupid, he thought, to be so suspicious. He put down the cup. Good, he said. Very good. He looked at her as she stared into the coffee. If you are infected, he told her, I'll do everything I can to cure you. Her eyes met his.
And if you can't? She said.
Silence a moment. Let's wait and see, he said then. They both drank coffee. Then he asked, shall we do it now?
Please, she said. In the morning, I still feel a little ill.
All right, he said, nodding. In the morning. They finished their meal in silence. Neville felt only a small satisfaction that she was going to let him check her blood. He was afraid he might discover that she was infected. In the meantime, he had to pass an evening and night with her, perhaps get to know her and be attracted to her, when in the morning he might have to. Later, in the living room, they sat looking at the mural, sipping port, and listening to Schubert's Fourth Symphony.
I wouldn't have believed it, she said, seeming to cheer up. I never thought I'd be listening to music again. Drinking wine?
She looked around the room.
You've certainly done a wonderful job, she said.
What about your house? He asked.
It was nothing like this, she said. We didn't have a...
How did you protect your house? He interrupted.
Oh, she thought a moment. We had it boarded up, of course, and we used crosses.
They don't always work, he said quietly, after a moment of looking at her. She looked blank.
They don't?
Why should a Jew fear the cross? He said. Why should a vampire who had been a Jew fear it? Most people were afraid of becoming vampires. Most of them suffer from hysterical blindness before mirrors. But as far as the cross goes, well, neither a Jew nor a Hindu nor a Mohammedan nor an atheist, for that matter, would fear the cross. She sat holding her wine glass and looking at him with expressionless eyes. That's why the cross doesn't always work, he said.
You didn't let me finish, she said. We used garlic, too.
I thought it made you sick.
I was already sick. I used to weigh 120. I weigh 98 pounds now.
He nodded. But as he went into the kitchen to get another bottle of wine, he thought, she would have adjusted to it by now, after 3 years. Then again, she might not have. What was the point in doubting her now? She was going to let him check her blood. What else could she do? It's me, he thought. I've been by myself too long. I won't believe anything unless I see it in a microscope. Heredity triumphs again. I'm my father's son. Damn his moldering bones. Standing in the dark kitchen, digging his blunt nail under the wrapping around the neck of the bottle, Robert Neville looked into the living room at Ruth. His eyes ran over the robe, resting a moment on the slight prominence of her breasts, dropping then to the bronzed calves and ankles, up to the smooth kneecaps. She had a body like a young girl's. She certainly didn't look like the mother of two. The most unusual feature of the entire affair, he thought, was that he felt no physical desire for her. If she had come 2 years before, maybe even later, he might have violated her. There had been some terrible moments in those days, moments when the most terrible of solutions to his need were considered, were often dwelt upon, until they drove him half mad. But then the experiments had begun. Smoking had tapered off, drinking lost its compulsive nature. Deliberately and with surprising success, he had submerged himself in investigation. His sex drive had diminished, had virtually disappeared. Salvation of the monk, he thought. The drive had to go sooner or later, or no normal man could dedicate himself to any life that excluded sex. Now, happily, he felt almost nothing. Perhaps a hardly discernible stirring far beneath the rocky strata of abstinence. He was content to leave it at that, especially since there was no certainty that Ruth was the companion he had waited for, or even the certainty that he could allow her to live beyond tomorrow. Cure her? Curing was unlikely. He went back into the living room with the opened bottle. She smiled at him briefly as he poured more wine for her.
"I've been admiring your mural," she said. "It almost makes you believe you're in the woods."
He grunted.
"It must have taken a lot of work to get your house like this," she said.
"You should know," he said. "You went through the same thing."
"We had nothing like this," she said. "Our house was small. Our food locker was half the size of yours."
"You must have run out of food," he said, looking at her carefully.
"Frozen food," she said. "We were living out of cans."
He nodded. Logical, his mind had to admit. But he still didn't like it. It was all intuition, he knew, but he didn't like it. "What about water?" he asked then. She looked at him silently for a moment.
"You don't believe a word I've said, do you?" she said.
"It's not that," he said. "I'm just curious how you lived."
"You can't hide it from your voice," she said. "You've been alone too long. You've lost the talent for deceit."
He grunted, getting the uncomfortable feeling that she was playing with him. "That's ridiculous," he argued. "She's just a woman. She was probably right. He probably was a gruff and graceless hermit. What did it matter? Tell me about your husband," he said abruptly. Something flitted over her face, a shade of memory. She lifted the glass of dark wine to her lips.
"Not now," she said. "Please."
He slumped back on the couch, unable to analyze the formless dissatisfaction he felt. Everything she said and did could be a result of what she'd been through. It could also be a lie. Why should she lie? He asked himself. In the morning, he would check her blood. What could lying tonight profit her, when, in a matter of hours, he'd know the truth? "You know," he said, trying to ease the moment, "I've been thinking, if 3 people could survive the plague, why not more?"
"Do you think that's possible?" she asked.
"Why not? There must have been others who were immune for one reason or another."
"Tell me more about the germ," she said.
He hesitated a moment, then put down his wine glass. What if he told her everything? What if she escaped and came back after death with all the knowledge that he had?
"There's an awful lot of detail," he said. "You were saying something about the cross before," she said. "How do you know it's true?"
"You remember what I said about Ben Cortman?" he said, glad to restate something she already knew rather than go into fresh material.
"You mean that man you..."
He nodded. "Yes, come here," he said, standing. "I'll show him to you." As he stood behind her looking out the peephole, he smelled the odor of her hair and skin. It made him draw back a little. "Isn't that remarkable?" he thought. "I don't like the smell. Like Gulliver returning from the logical horses, I find the human smell offensive." "He's the one by the lamppost," he said. She made a slight sound of acknowledgement. Then she said,
"There are so few. Where are they?"
"I've killed off most of them," he said, "but they managed to keep a few ahead of me."
"How come the lamp is on out there?" she said. "I thought they destroyed the electrical system."
"I connected it with my generator," he said, "so I could watch them."
"Don't they break the bulb?"
"I have a very strong globe over the bulb."
"Don't they climb up and try to break it?"
"I have garlic all over the post." She shook her head.
"You've thought of everything."
Stepping back, he looked at her a moment. How can she look at them so calmly, he wondered, ask me questions, make comments, when only a week ago she saw their kind tear her husband to pieces? Doubts again, he thought. Won't they ever stop? He knew they wouldn't until he knew about her for sure. She turned away from the window then.
"Will you excuse me a moment?" she said.
He watched her walk into the bathroom and heard her lock the door behind her. Then he went back to the couch after closing the peephole door. A wry smile played on his lips. He looked down into the tawny wine depths and tugged abstractedly at his beard. "Will you excuse me a moment?" For some reason, the word seemed grotesquely amusing, the carryover from a lost age. Emily Post mincing through the graveyard, etiquette for young vampires. The smile was gone. And what now? What did the future hold for him? In a week, would she still be here with him, or crumpled in the never-cooling fire? He knew that if she were infected, he'd have to try to cure her, whether it worked or not. But what if she were free of the bacillus? In a way, that was a more nerve-wracking possibility. The other way, he would merely go on as before, breaking neither schedule nor standards. But if she stayed, if they had to establish a relationship, perhaps become husband and wife, have children. Yes, that was more terrifying. He suddenly realized that he had become an ill-tempered and inveterate bachelor again. He no longer thought about his wife, his child, his past life. The present was enough, and he was afraid of the possible demand that he make sacrifices and accept responsibility again. He was afraid of giving out his heart, of removing the chains he had forged around it to keep emotion prisoner. He was afraid of loving again. When she came out of the bathroom, he was still sitting there, thinking. The record player, unnoticed by him, let out only a thin scratching sound. Ruth lifted the record from the turntable and turned it. The third movement of the symphony began.
"Well, what about Cortman?"
she asked, sitting down. He looked at her blankly. "Cortman?"
"You were going to tell me something about him and the cross."
"Oh. Well, one night I got him in here and showed him the cross."
"What happened?"
"Shall I kill her now? Shall I not even investigate, but kill her and burn her?" His throat moved. Such thoughts were a hideous testimony to the world he had accepted, a world in which murder was easier than hope. Well, he wasn't that far gone yet, he thought. I'm a man, not a destroyer.
"What's wrong?"
she said nervously.
"What?" "You're staring at me."
"I'm sorry," he said coldly. I'm just thinking." She didn't say any more. She drank her wine, and he saw her hand shake as she held the glass. He forced down all introspection. He didn't want her to know what he felt. "When I showed him the cross," he said, "he laughed in my face." She nodded once. "But when I held a Torah before his eyes, I got the reaction I wanted."
"A what?"
"A Torah. Tablet of Law, I believe it is."
"And that got a reaction?"
"Yes. I had him tied up, but when he saw the Torah, he broke loose and attacked me."
"What happened?"
She seemed to have lost her fright again. "He struck me on the head with something. I don't remember what. I was almost knocked out, but using the Torah, I backed him to the door and got rid of him."
"Oh."
"So you see, the cross hasn't the power the legend says it has. My theory is that, since the legend came into its own in Europe, a continent predominantly Catholic, the cross would naturally become the symbol of defense against powers of darkness."
"Couldn't you use your gun on Cortman?"
she asked. "How did you know I had a gun?"
"I assumed as much," she said. "We had guns."
"Then you must know bullets have no effect on vampires."
"We were never sure," she said,
then went on quickly.
"Do you know why that's so? Why don't bullets affect them?"
He shook his head. "I don't know," he said. They sat in silence, listening to the music. He did know, but, doubting again, he didn't want to tell her. Through experiments on the dead vampires, he had discovered that the bacilli affected the creation of a powerful body glue that sealed bullet openings as soon as they were made. Bullets were enclosed almost immediately, and since the system was activated by germs, a bullet couldn't hurt it. The system could, in fact, contain almost an indefinite amount of bullets, since the body glue prevented a penetration of more than a few fractions of an inch. Shooting vampires was like throwing pebbles into tar. As he sat looking at her, she arranged the folds of the robe around her legs, and he got a momentary glimpse of brown thigh. Far from being attracted, he felt irritated. It was a typical feminine gesture, he thought, an artificial movement. As the moments passed, he could almost sense himself drifting farther and farther from her. In a way, he almost regretted having found her at all. Through the years, he had achieved a certain degree of peace, he had accepted solitude, found it not half bad. Now this, ending it all. In order to fill the emptiness of the moment, he reached for his pipe and pouch. He stuffed tobacco into the bowl and lit it. For a second, he wondered if he should ask if she minded. He didn't ask. The music ended. She got up, and he watched her while she looked through his records. She seemed like a young girl, she was so slender. Who is she? He thought. Who is she really?
May I play this?
She asked, holding up an album. He didn't even look at it. If you like, he said. She sat down as Rachmaninoff's second piano concerto began. Her taste isn't remarkably advanced, he thought, looking at her without expression.
Tell me about yourself, she said.
Another typical feminine question, he thought. Then he berated himself for being so critical. What was the point in irritating himself by doubting her? Nothing to tell, he said. She was smiling again.
Was she laughing at him? You scared the life out of me this afternoon, she said. You and your bristly beard and those wild eyes.
He blew out smoke. Wild eyes? That was ridiculous. What was she trying to do? Break down his reserve with cuteness?
What do you look like under all those whiskers? She asked.
He tried to smile at her, but he couldn't. Nothing, he said. Just an ordinary face.
How old are you, Robert?
His throat moved. It was the first time she'd spoken his name. It gave him a strange, restless feeling to hear a woman speak his name after so long. Don't call me that, he almost said to her. He didn't want to lose the distance between them. If she were infected and he couldn't cure her, he wanted it to be a stranger that he put away. She turned her head away.
You don't have to talk to me if you don't want to, she said quietly. I won't bother you. I'll go tomorrow.
His chest muscles tightened.
But, he said, I don't want to spoil your life, she said. You don't have to feel any obligation to me just because we're the only ones left.
His eyes were bleak as he looked at her, and he felt a brief stirring of guilt at her words. Why should I doubt her? He told himself. If she's infected, she'll never get away alive. What's there to fear? I'm sorry, he said. I have been alone a long time. She didn't look up. If you'd like to talk, he said, I'd be glad to tell you anything I can. She hesitated a moment. Then she looked at him, her eyes not committing themselves at all.
I would like to know about the disease, she said. I lost my two girls because of it, and it caused my husband's death.
He looked at her and then spoke. It's a bacillus, he said, a cylindrical bacterium. It creates an isotonic solution in the blood, circulates the blood slower than normal, activates all bodily functions, lives on fresh blood, and provides energy. Deprived of blood, it makes self-killing bacteriophages, or else sporulates. She looked blank. He realized then that she couldn't have understood. Terms so common to him now were completely foreign to her. Well, he said, most of those things aren't so important. To sporulate is to create an oval body that has all the basic ingredients of the vegetative bacterium. The germ does that when it gets no fresh blood. Then, when the vampire host decomposes, these spores go flying out and seek new hosts. They find one, germinate, and one more system is infected. She shook her head incredulously. Bacteriophages are inanimate proteins that are also created when the system gets no blood. Unlike the spores, though, in this case, abnormal metabolism destroys the cells. Quickly, he told her about the imperfect waste disposal of the lymphatic system, the garlic as allergen causing anaphylaxis, the various vectors of the disease.
Then why are we immune? She asked.
For a long moment, he looked at her, withholding any answer. Then, with a shrug, he said, I don't know about you. As for me, while I was stationed in Panama during the war, I was bitten by a vampire bat. And though I can't prove it, my theory is that the bat had previously encountered a true vampire and acquired the vampirous germ. The germ caused the bat to seek human rather than animal blood, but by the time the germ had passed into my system, it had been weakened in some way by the bat system. It made me terribly ill, of course, but it didn't kill me, and as a result, my body built up an immunity to it. That's my theory, anyway. I can't find any better reason.
But didn't the same thing happen to others down there?
I don't know, he said quietly. I killed the bat. He shrugged. Maybe I was the first human it had attacked. She looked at him without a word, her surveillance making Neville feel restive. He went on talking, even though he didn't really want to. Briefly, he told her about the major obstacle in his study of the vampires. At first, I thought the stake had to hit their hearts, he said. I believed the legend. I found out that wasn't so. I put stakes in all parts of their bodies, and they died. That made me think it was hemorrhage. But then one day... And he told her about the woman who had decomposed before his eyes. I knew then it couldn't be hemorrhage, he went on, feeling a sort of pleasure in reciting his discoveries. I didn't know what to do. Then one day it came to me.
What?
She asked. I took a dead vampire. I put his arm into an artificial vacuum. I punctured his arm inside that vacuum. Blood spurted out. He paused. But that's all. She stared at him. You don't see, he said.
I... no,
she admitted. When I let air back into the tank, the arm decomposed, he said. She still stared. You see, he said, the bacillus is a facultative saprophyte. It lives with or without oxygen, but with a difference. Inside the system, it is anaerobic and sets up a symbiosis with the system. The vampire feeds it fresh blood, the bacteria provides the energy so the vampire can get more fresh blood. The germ also causes, I might add, the growth of the canine teeth.
Yes,
she said. When air enters, he said, the situation changes instantaneously. The germ becomes aerobic, and, instead of being symbiotic, it becomes virulently parasitic. He paused. It eats the host, he said.
Then the stake,
she started, lets air in. Of course. Lets it in and keeps the flesh open so that the body glue can't function. So the heart has nothing to do with it. What I do now is cut the wrists deep enough so that the body glue can't work. He smiled a little. When I think of all the time I used to spend making steaks. She nodded and, noticing the wine glass in her hand, put it down. That's why the woman I told you about broke down so rapidly, he said. She'd been dead so long that as soon as air struck her system, the germs caused spontaneous dissolution. Her throat moved and a shudder ran down through her.
It's horrible, she said.
He looked at her in surprise.
Horrible?
Wasn't that odd? He hadn't thought of that for years. For him, the word horror had become obsolete. A surfeiting of terror soon made terror a cliché. To Robert Neville, the situation merely existed as natural fact. It had no adjectives.
And what about the ones who were still alive?
She asked. Well, he said, when you cut their wrists, the germ naturally becomes parasitic, but mostly they die from simple hemorrhage.
Simple?
She turned away quickly, and her lips were pressed into a tight, thin line. What's the matter? He asked.
Nothing. Nothing,
she said. He smiled. One gets used to these things, he said. One has to. Again she shuddered, the smooth column of her throat contracting. You can't abide by Robert's rules of order in the jungle, he said. Believe me, it's the only thing I can do. Is it better to let them die of the disease and return in a far more terrible way? She pressed her hands together.
But you said a lot of them are still living, she said nervously. How do you know they're not going to stay alive?
I know, he said. I know the germ, know how it multiplies. No matter how long their systems fight it, in the end, the germ will win. I've made antibiotics, injected dozens of them, but it doesn't work. It can't work. You can't make vaccines work when they're already deep in the disease. Their bodies can't fight germs and make antibodies at the same time. It can't be done, believe me. It's a trap. If I didn't kill them, sooner or later they'd die and come after me. I have no choice. No choice at all. They were silent then. And the only sound in the room was the rasping of the needle on the inner grooves of the record. She wouldn't look at him, but kept staring at the floor with bleak eyes. It was strange, he thought, to find himself vaguely on the defensive for what yesterday was accepted necessity. In the years that had passed, he had never once considered the possibility that he was wrong. It took her presence to bring about such thoughts, and they were strange, alien thoughts. "Do you actually think I'm wrong?" he asked in an incredulous voice. She bit into her lower lip. "Ruth," he said.
"It's not for me to say," she answered.
Chapter 18.
"Virge!"
The dark form recoiled against the wall as Robert Neville's hoarse cry ripped open the silent blackness. He jerked his body up from the couch and stared with sleep-clouded eyes across the room, his chest pulsing with heartbeats like maniac fists on a dungeon wall. He lurched up to his feet, brain still foggy with sleep, unable to define time or place.
"Virge,"
he said again, weakly, shakily.
"Virge,
it's me,"
the faltering voice said in the darkness. He took a trembling step toward the thin stream of light spearing through the open peephole. He blinked dully at the light. She gasped as he put his hand out and clutched her shoulder.
"It's Ruth. Ruth,"
she said in a terrified whisper. He stood there rocking slowly in the darkness, eyes gazing without comprehension at the dark form before him.
"It's Ruth,"
she said again, more loudly. Waking came like a hose blast of numbing shock. Something twisted cold knots into his chest and stomach. It wasn't Virge. He shook his head suddenly, rubbed shaking fingers across his eyes. Then he stood there staring, weighted beneath a sudden depression.
"Oh," he muttered faintly. "Oh, I..."
He remained there, feeling his body weaving slowly in the dark as the mists cleared from his brain. He looked at the open peephole, then back at her.
"What are you doing?" he asked, voice still thick with sleep. "Nothing," she said nervously. "I couldn't sleep."
He blinked his eyes suddenly at the flaring lamplight. Then his hands dropped down from the lamp switch and he turned around. She was against the wall still, blinking at the light, her hands at her sides drawn into tight fists. "Why are you dressed?" he asked in a surprised voice. Her throat moved and she stared at him. He rubbed his eyes again and pushed back the long hair from his temples.
"I was just looking out," she said.
"But why are you dressed?"
"I couldn't sleep."
He stood looking at her, still a little groggy, feeling his heartbeat slowly diminish. Through the open peephole, he heard them yelling outside, and he heard Cortman shout, "Come out, Neville!" Moving to the peephole, he pushed the small wooden door shut and turned to her.
"I want to know why you're dressed," he said again.
"No reason," she said.
"Were you going to leave while I was asleep?"
"No, I..."
"Were you?"
She gasped as he grabbed her wrist.
"No, no," she said quickly. "How could I, with them out there?"
He stood breathing heavily, looking at her frightened face. His throat moved slowly as he remembered the shock of waking up and thinking that she was Virge. Abruptly, he dropped her arm and turned away. And he'd thought the past was dead. How long did it take for a past to die? She said nothing as he poured a tumbler full of whiskey and swallowed it convulsively.
"Virge, Virge," he thought miserably, "still with me."
He closed his eyes and jammed his teeth together.
"Was that her name?"
he heard Ruth ask. His muscles tightened, then went slack.
"It's all right," he said in a dead voice. "Go to bed."
She drew back a little.
"I'm sorry," she said. "I didn't mean..."
Suddenly he knew he didn't want her to go to bed. He wanted her to stay with him. He didn't know why. He just didn't want to be alone.
"I thought you were my wife," he heard himself saying. "I woke up and I thought..."
He drank a mouthful of whiskey, coughing as part of it went down the wrong way. Ruth stayed in the shadows, listening.
"She came back, you see," he said. I buried her, but one night she came back. She looked like you did. An outline, a shadow. Dead. But she came back. I tried to keep her with me. I tried, but she wasn't the same anymore, you see. All she wanted was... He forced down the sob in his throat. My own wife, he said in a trembling voice. Coming back to drink my blood. He jammed down the glass on the bar top. Turning away, he paced restlessly to the peephole, turned and went back and stood again before the bar. Ruth said nothing. She just stood in the darkness, listening. I put her away again, he said. I had to do the same thing to her I'd done to the others. My own wife. There was a clicking in his throat. A stake, he said in a terrible voice. I had to put a stake in her. It was the only thing I knew to do. He couldn't finish. He stood there a long time, shivering helplessly, his eyes tightly shut. Then he spoke again. Almost 3 years ago I did that, and I still remember it. It's still with me. What can you do? What can you do? He drove a fist down on the bar top. As the anguish of memory swept over him again. No matter how hard you try, you can't forget or adjust or ever get away from it. He ran shaking fingers through his hair. I know what you feel. I know. I didn't at first. I didn't trust you. I was safe, secure in my little shell. Now, he shook his head slowly, defeatedly. In a second, it's all gone. Adjustment. Security, peace, all gone.
Robert?
Her voice was as broken and lost as his.
Why were we punished like this?
She asked. He drew in a shuddering breath.
I don't know, he answered bitterly. There's no answer, no reason. It just is.
She was close to him now. And suddenly, without hesitation or drawing back, he drew her against him, and they were two people holding each other tightly in the lost measure of night.
Robert. Robert.
Her hands rubbed over his back, stroking and clutching, while his arms held her firmly, and he pressed his eyes shut against her warm, soft hair. Their mouths held together for a long time, and her arms gripped with desperate tightness around his neck. Then they were sitting in the darkness, pressing close together, as if all the heat in the world were in their bodies, and they would share the warmth between them. He felt the shuddering rise and fall of her breasts as she held close to him, her arms tight around his body, her face against his neck. His big hands moved roughly through her hair, stroking and feeling the silky strands. I'm sorry, Ruth.
Sorry?
For being so cruel to you, for not trusting you. She was silent, holding tight.
Oh, Robert, she said then, it's so unfair, so unfair. Why are we still alive? Why aren't we all dead? It would be better if we were all dead.
Shh, shh,
he said, feeling emotion for her, like a released current pouring from his heart and mind.
It'll be all right.
He felt her shaking her head slowly against him.
It will. It will, he said.
How can it?
It will, he said,
even though he knew he really couldn't believe it, even though he knew it was only released tension forming words in his mind.
No,
she said.
No.
Yes, it will. It will, Ruth.
He didn't know how long it was they sat there holding each other close. He forgot everything, time and place. It was just the two of them together, needing each other, survivors of a black terror embracing because they had found each other. But then he wanted to do something for her, to help her.
Come, he said. We'll check you.
She stiffened in his arms.
No, no, he said quickly. Don't be afraid. I'm sure we won't find anything, but if we do, I'll cure you. I swear I'll cure you, Ruth.
She was looking at him in the darkness, not saying a word. He stood and pulled her up with him, trembling with an excitement he hadn't felt in endless years. He wanted to cure her, to help her.
"Let me," he said. "I won't hurt you, I promise I won't. Let's know. Let's find out for sure. Then we can plan and work. I'll save you, Ruth. I will. Or I'll die myself."
She was still tense, holding back.
"Come with me, Ruth."
Now that the strength of his reserve had gone, there was nothing left to brace himself on, and he was shaking like a palsied man. He led her into the bedroom, and when he saw in the lamplight how frightened she was, he pulled her close and stroked her hair.
"It's all right," he said. "All right, Ruth. No matter what we find, it'll be all right. Don't you understand?"
He sat her down on the stool, and her face was completely blank, her body shuddering as he heated the needle over a Bunsen flame. He bent down and kissed her on the cheek.
"It's all right now," he said gently. "It's all right."
She closed her eyes as he jabbed in the needle. He could feel the pain in his own finger as he pressed out blood and rubbed it on the slide.
"There, there," he said anxiously, pressing a little cotton to the nick on her finger.
He felt himself trembling helplessly. No matter how he tried to control it, he couldn't. His fingers were almost incapable of making the slide, and he kept looking at Ruth and smiling at her, trying to take the look of taut fright from her features.
"Don't be afraid," he said. "Please don't. I'll cure you if you're infected. I will, Ruth. I will."
She sat without a word, looking at him with listless eyes as he worked. Her hands kept stirring restlessly in her lap.
"What will you do if I am?"
she said then.
"I'm not sure," he said. "Not yet. But there are a lot of things we can do."
"What?"
"Vaccines, for one."
"You said vaccines didn't work,"
she said, her voice shaking a little.
"Yes, but..."
He broke off as he slid the glass slide onto the microscope.
"Robert, what could you do?"
She slid off the stool as he bent over the microscope.
"Robert, don't look,"
she begged suddenly, her voice pleading. But he'd already seen. He didn't realize that his breath had stopped. His blank eyes met hers.
"Ruth,"
he whispered in a shocked voice. The wooden mallet crashed down on his forehead. A burst of pain filled Robert Neville's head, and he felt one leg give way. As he fell to one side, he knocked over the microscope. His right knee hit the floor, and he looked up in dazed bewilderment at her fright-twisted face. The mallet came down again, and he cried out in pain. He fell to both knees, and his palms struck the floor as he toppled forward. 100 miles away, he heard her gasping sob.
"Ruth," he mumbled. "I told you not to," she cried.
He clutched out at her legs, and she drove the mallet down a third time, this time on the back of his skull.
"Ruth!"
Robert Neville's hands went limp and slid off her calves, rubbing away part of the tan. He fell on his face, and his fingers drew in convulsively as night filled his brain. Chapter 19. When he opened his eyes, there was no sound in the house. He lay there a moment, looking confusedly at the floor. Then, with a startled grunt, he sat up. A package of needles exploded in his head, and he slumped down on the cold floor, hands pressed to his throbbing skull. A clicking sound filled his throat as he lay there. After a few minutes, he pulled himself up slowly by gripping the edge of the bench. The floor undulated beneath him as he held on tightly, eyes closed, legs wavering. A minute later, he managed to stumble into the bathroom. There he threw cold water in his face and sat on the bathtub edge, pressing a cold, wet cloth to his forehead.
What had happened?
He kept blinking and staring at the white-tiled floor. He stood up and walked slowly into the living room. It was empty. The front door stood half open in the gray of early morning. She was gone. Then he remembered. He struggled back to the bedroom, using the walls to guide him. The note was on the bench next to the overturned microscope. He picked up the paper with numbed fingers and carried it to the bed. Sinking down with a groan, he He held the letter before his eyes, but the letters blurred and ran. He shook his head and pressed his eyes shut. After a little while, he read.
Robert, now you know. Know that I was spying on you. Know that almost everything I told you was a lie. I'm writing this note, though, because I want to save you if I can. When I was first given the job of spying on you, I had no feelings about your life, because I did have a husband, Robert. You killed him. But now it's different. I know now that you were just as much forced into your situation as we were forced into ours. We are infected, but you already know that. What you don't understand yet is that we're going to stay alive. We've found a way to do that, and we're going to set up society again, slowly but surely. We're going to do away with all those wretched creatures whom death has cheated. And even though I pray otherwise, we may decide to kill you and those like you.
Those like me? He thought with a start, but he kept reading.
I'll try to save you. I'll tell them you're too well armed for us to attack now. Use the time I'm giving you, Robert. Get away from your house, go into the mountains and save yourself. There are only a handful of us now, but sooner or later we'll be too well organized, and nothing I say will stop the rest from destroying you. For God's sake, Robert, go now while you can. I know you may not believe this. You may not believe that we can live in the sun for short periods now. You may not believe that my tan was only makeup. You may not believe that we can live with the germ now. That's why I'm leaving one of my pills. I took them all the time I was here. I kept them in a belt around my waist. You'll discover that they're a combination of defibrinated blood and a drug. I don't know myself just what it is. The blood feeds the germs. The drug prevents its multiplication. It was the discovery of this pill that saved us from dying, that is helping to set up society again slowly. Believe me, it's true. And escape. Forgive me, too. I didn't mean to hit you. It nearly killed me to do it, but I was so terribly frightened of what you'd do when you found out. Forgive me for having to lie to you about so many things, but please believe this. When we were together in the darkness, close to each other, I wasn't spying on you. I was loving you. Ruth.
He read the letter again. Then his hands fell forward, and he sat there staring with empty eyes at the floor. He couldn't believe it. He shook his head slowly and tried to understand, but adjustment eluded him. He walked unsteadily to the bench. He picked up the small amber pill and held it in his palm, smelled it, tasted it. He felt as if all the security of reason were ebbing away from him. The framework of his life was collapsing, and it frightened him. Yet how did he refute the evidence? The pill, the tan coming off her leg, her walking in the sun, her reaction to garlic. He sank down on the stool and looked at the mallet lying on the floor. Slowly, ploddingly, his mind went over the evidence. When he'd first seen her, she'd run from him. Had it been a ruse? No, she'd been genuinely frightened. She must have been startled by his cry then, even though she'd been expecting it, and forgotten all about her job. Then later, when she'd calmed down, she'd talked him into thinking that her reaction to garlic was the reaction of a sick stomach. And she had lied and smiled and feigned hopeless acceptance and carefully got all the information she'd been sent after. And when she'd wanted to leave, she couldn't because of Cortman and the others. He had awakened then. They had embraced. They had... His white-knuckled fist jolted down on the bench. I was loving you. Lie, lie! His fingers crumpled up the letter and flung it away bitterly. Rage made the pain in his head flare hotly, and he pressed both hands against it and closed his eyes with a groan. Then he looked up. Slowly he slid off the stool and placed the microscope back on its base. The rest of her letter wasn't a lie. He knew that. Without the pill, without any evidence of word or memory, he knew. He knew what even Ruth and her people didn't seem to know. He He looked into the eyepiece for a long time. Yes, he knew. And the admission of what he saw changed his entire world. How stupid and ineffective he felt for never having foreseen it.
Especially after reading the phrase 100, 1,000 times. But then, he'd never really appreciated it.
Such a short phrase it was, but meaning so much. Bacteria can mutate.
Part 4, January 1979. Chapter 20. They came by night, came in their dark cars with their spotlights and their guns and their axes and pikes, came from the blackness with a great sound of motors, the long white arms of their spotlights snapping around the boulevard corner and clutching out at Cimarron Street. Robert Neville was sitting at the peephole when they came. He had put down a book and was sitting there watching idly when the beams splashed white across the bloodless vampire faces and they whirled with a gasp, their dark animal eyes staring at the blinding lights. Neville jumped back from the peephole, his heart thudding with the abrupt shock. For a moment he stood there trembling in the dark room, unable to decide what to do. His throat contracted, and he heard the roar of the car motors even through the soundproofing on his house. He thought of the pistols in his bureau, the submachine gun on his workbench, thought of defending his house against them. Then he pressed his fingers in until the nails dug at his palms. No. He'd made his decision. He'd worked it out carefully through the past months. He would not fight. With a heavy, sinking sensation in the pit of his stomach, he stepped back to the peephole and looked out. The street was a scene of rushing, violent action illuminated by the bald glare of the spotlights. Men rushed at men. The sound of running boots covered the pavement. Then a shot rang out, echoing hollowly. More shots. Two male vampires went thrashing down onto their sides. Four men grabbed them by the arms and jerked them up while two other men drove the glittering lance points of their pikes into the vampires' chests. Neville's face twitched as screams filled the night. He felt his chest shuddering with labored breath as he watched from his house. The dark-suited men knew exactly what they were doing. There were about 7 vampires visible, 6 men and a woman. The men surrounded the 7, held their flailing arms, and drove razor-tipped pikes deep into their bodies. Blood spouted out on the dark pavement, and the vampires perished one by one. Neville felt himself shivering more and more. "Is this the new society?" the words flashed across his mind. He tried to believe that the men were forced into what they were doing, but shock brought terrible doubt. Did they have to do it like this, with such a black and brutal slaughtering? Why did they slay with alarum by night, when by day the vampires could be dispatched in peace? Robert Neville felt tight fists shaking at his sides. He didn't like the looks of them. He didn't like the methodical butchery. They were more like gangsters than men forced into a situation. There were looks of vicious triumph on their faces, white and stark in the spotlights. Their faces were cruel and emotionless. Suddenly Neville felt himself shudder violently, remembering, where was Ben Cortman? His eyes fled over the street, but he couldn't see Cortman. He pressed against the peephole and looked up and down the street. He didn't want them to get Cortman, he realized. Didn't want them to destroy Cortman like that. With a sense of inward shock he could not analyze in the rush of the moment, he realized that he felt more deeply toward the vampires than he did toward their executioners. Now the 7 vampires lay crumpled and still in their pools of stolen blood. The spotlights were moving around the street, flaying open the night. Neville turned his head away as the brilliant glare blazed across the front of his house. Then the spotlight had turned about, and he looked again. A shout. Neville's eyes jumped toward the focus of the spotlights. He stiffened. Cortman was on the roof of the house across the street. He was pulling himself up toward the chimney, body flattened on the shingles. Abruptly it came to Neville that it was in that chimney that Ben Cortman had hidden most of the time, and he felt a wrench of despair at the knowledge.
his lips pressed together tightly. Why hadn't he looked more carefully? He couldn't fight the sick apprehension he felt at the thought of Corpman's being killed by these brutal strangers. Objectively, it was pointless, but he could not repress the feeling. Corpman was not theirs to put to rest. But there was nothing he could do. With bleak, tortured eyes, he watched the spotlights cluster on Cortman's wriggling body. He watched the white hands reaching out slowly for handholds on the roof. Slowly, slowly, as if Cortman had all the time in the world. "Hurry up!" Neville felt himself twitch with the unspoken words as he watched. He felt himself straining with Cortman's agonizingly slow movements. The men did not shout. They did not command. They raised their rifles now, and the night was torn open again with their exploding fire. Neville almost felt the bullets in his own flesh. His body jerked with convulsive shudders as he watched Cortman's body jerk under the impact of the bullets. Still, Cortman kept crawling, and Neville saw his white face, his teeth gritted together. The end of Oliver Hardy, he thought. The death of all comedy and all laughter. He didn't hear the continuous fusillade of shots. He didn't even feel the tears running down his cheeks. His eyes were riveted on the ungainly form of his old friend inching up the brightly lit roof. Now Cortman rose up on his knees and clutched at the chimney edge with spasmodic fingers. His body lurched as more bullets struck. His dark eyes glared into the blinding spotlights. His lips were drawn back in a soundless snarl. Then he was standing up beside the chimney, and Neville's face was white and taut as he watched Cortman start to raise his right leg. And then the hammering machine gun splattered Cortman's flesh with lead. For a moment, Cortman stood erect in the hot blast, palsied hands raised high over his head, a look of berserk defiance twisting his white features. "Ben," Neville muttered in a croaking whisper. Ben Cortman's body folded, slumped forward, fell. It slid and rolled slowly down the shingled incline, then dropped into space. In the sudden silence, Neville heard the thump of it from across the street. Sick-eyed, he watched the men rush at the writhing body with their pikes. Then Neville closed his eyes, and his nails dug furrows in the flesh of his palms. A clumping of boots. Neville jerked back into the darkness. He stood in the middle of the room, waiting for them to call to him and tell him to come out. He held himself rigidly. "I'm not going to fight," he told himself strongly, even though he wanted to fight, even though he already hated the dark men with their guns and their blood-stained pikes. But he was not going to fight. He had worked out his decision very carefully. They were doing what they had to do, albeit with unnecessary violence and seeming relish. He had killed their people, and they had to capture him and save themselves. He would not fight. He'd throw himself upon the justice of their new society. When they called to him, he would go out and surrender. It was his decision. But they didn't call. Neville lurched back with a gasp as the axe blade bit deeply into the front door. He stood trembling in the dark living room. What were they doing? Why didn't they call on him to surrender? He wasn't a vampire, he was a man like them. What were they doing? He whirled and stared at the kitchen. They were chopping at the boarded-up back door, too. He took a nervous step toward the hallway. His frightened eyes rushed from the back to the front door. He felt his heart pumping. He didn't understand. He didn't understand. With a grunt of shocked surprise, he jumped into the hall as the enclosed house rang with the gun explosion. The men were shooting away the lock on the front door. Another reverberating shot made his ears ring. And suddenly he knew. They weren't going to take him to their courts, to their justice. They were going to exterminate him. With a frightened murmur, he ran into the bedroom. His hands fumbled in the bureau drawer. He straightened up on trembling legs, the guns in his hands. But what if they were going to take him prisoner? He'd only judged by the fact that they hadn't called on him to come out. There were no lights in his house. Maybe they thought he was already gone. He stood shivering in the darkness of the bedroom, not knowing what to do, mutters of terror filling his throat. Why hadn't he left? Why hadn't he listened to her and left?
fool.
One of his guns fell from nerveless fingers as the front door was crushed in. Heavy feet thudded into the living room.